Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Willie, Harry, Stee, Harry, Dick, John, Harry, 3, 1, 2, 3, Neds, Richard, 2, Henrys, 4, 5, 6, Enhu, Edward, 4, 5, Dick the Bad, Harry's Twain and Ned the Lad, Mary, Bessie, James, Evane, Charlie, James again, William and Mary, Anna, Gloria, 4 Georges, William and Victoria, then comes Edward. Edward the 7th. He was actually christened Albert Edward. Albert after his father, Prince Albert. Queen Victoria's husband, the Prince Consort. And as you know, if you've listened to the episode on Victoria, well, actually everybody kind of knows, Victoria was absolutely devoted to Albert and was distraught when he died. And originally, yes, Edward was named after his father, Albert. But Edward never seemed to really like the name, partly because of his relationship with Albert, which I'll come on to in a minute. But in public, he always said, I can't live up to this man. There will only ever be one Albert, and that was my father. But I think really he wanted to be his own man and not to permanently be in the shadow of Albert. Victoria really hoped that when Edward came to the throne, he would be our first King Albert, but he wasn't. He chose his second name, Edward. In the last episode, we looked at how Victoria was a sort of newfangled imported name from Germany. Albert was as well, really. And it's interesting that it became such a common working class name. It was a sort of default name used if you were going to personify a working class man. Oh, and look, here's Bert the chimney sweep. But as I say, Edward didn't want to be Albert. His family had always called him Bertie, which I guess he was comfortable with because it was one step removed from Albert. He was also known by various nicknames, including Edward the Caresser, because he famously enjoyed the company of women and had a string of mistresses. He was also called Tum Tum, although not to his face. Edward always had big appetites for food, for sex, for cigarettes and cigars. But unlike the similarly greedy George IV, he didn't actually drink that much. He enjoyed a glass of champagne, but he was not a heavy drinker. He wasn't known as being a drunk, but he did like his grub. He ate a full meal at breakfast. He had lunch, tea, dinner, which was normally 12 courses, and he stuck to that through his life. And supper as well, which is a kind of sort of snack before bedtime, I guess. As I say, he didn't drink very much, but he smoked very heavily. He got through 12 huge cigars every day and 20 cigarettes. Eventually, all of this killed him, the food and the smoking. But he enjoyed himself along the way. He did grow enormously large. He had a 48-inch waist. One of the things that Edward was famous for was his interest in dress, in male fashion, in uniforms, in the correct way of wearing one's clothes. And he brought in many innovations. He started wearing tweed, inspired by his family trips to Balmoral in Scotland. And one of the tweeds became known as the Prince of Wales check. It still is today. He popularised the wearing of the Homburg hat, which was a German innovation. And probably most famously, he was the man who made it fashionable to leave the bottom button off one's waistcoat undone. That was the proper way of wearing a waistcoat. But it seems like so many of these fashions derived from the royals, that he started leaving his button undone because he simply couldn't do his waistcoat up over his vast belly. So that's Albert Edward, Bertie, Edward the Caresser, Tum Tum. He was born in 1841. He died in 1910, and just short of his 70th birthday. And despite living to what was for royals a relatively ripe old age, he only actually sat on the throne for the last 9 years of his life because, as we know, Victoria, up to that point, was our longest reigning monarch. It's interesting, these patterns. We'd seen it before with George III and George IV, where George III, before Victoria, had been the longest reigning monarch, and George IV was sort of champing at the bit, wanting to take the throne. Didn't actually become king until fairly late in life. He had had a run of it as Prince Regent, but it is an inevitable byproduct of a long reign that the next in line will come to the throne pretty late in life. It's exactly the same pattern as happened with Queen Elizabeth II and King Charles III. Charles came to the throne in 2023 at the age of 73. So he was older when he came to the throne than Edward VII was when he died. And sadly for Charles, soon after the coronation, he announced that he had cancer. So one hopes that it's not too serious and that he does go on to reign for a good long time. But Bertie, when he comes to the throne, unlike King George IV and I think with King Charles III, he didn't really want the job. He had been quite happy being the Prince of Wales, this playboy prince, having fun, doing whatever he wanted. And now he's on the throne and he's got to get on with making some pretense, at least, of looking like he knows what's going on and is interested in things. So he actually would have been happier just being the Prince of Wales for his whole life. So it was a short reign, less than 10 years. But still, he managed to get a whole era of our history named after him, the Edwardian era. And it's impossible not to look at the Edwardian era without hindsight, because we all know how it ended in the First World War. So the Edwardian era is seen as the sort of last flourishing of a golden age. We think of it as a time of innocence, really, with men in stripy blazers and white flannels and straw boaters and women in wide hats riding bicycles and people picnicking in punts. And the time feeling bright and light and open and fun, light-hearted, particularly after this sort of dark, gloomy, gothic Victorian era, sort of harking back to crusty medievalism. Now we have the new future, a future of motor cars, as I say, bicycles, of the suffragette movement, early moves towards some form of welfare state. And you can't help but wonder what would have happened if we hadn't slipped into the First World War. This absolute catastrophe, this awful descent into violence and death and destruction, a whole generation of young men wiped out. I'll be talking about the war, obviously, in the episode on George V, but the seeds of it, well, it goes back a long way. The problems between England and Germany started during Victoria's reign and got worse during Edward's reign. But was it really inevitable? Actually, I'm really looking forward to getting into this in the episode on George V, because I have to say, I don't really know exactly why the First World War happened. There seemed to have been this feeling of, OK, we might have a war with Germany. We're probably going to have a war. Now we're having a war. But as I say, I mustn't get sidetracked. Don't mention the war! Yes, so Edward VII was born in 1841. He had a pretty miserable childhood. Albert and Victoria were awful parents. The Hanoverians had this thing, which we've talked about a lot, and it's usually fathers hating their eldest sons, and in return, their eldest sons hating their fathers, and then when they have children, hating their own eldest sons. There's this idea that the son is not respecting you enough and that he might want to usurp your position. I don't know, but we had the same thing with Victoria and Edward. She never really liked him. And we saw in the last episode how she never really liked having children in the first place. She hated being pregnant. She suffered from postnatal depression. The whole business of having children stopped her from enjoying herself with Albert and spending time with him. And perhaps she resented young Edward for coming between her and Albert. Bertie did very poorly at lessons, and his parents quickly wrote him off as a half-wit, and ugly to boot. Victoria said of him, "Handsome, I cannot think him, with that painfully small and narrow head, those immense features, and total want of chin." She didn't ever really warm to him. Later in life, she said of him, "Bertie is not at all in good looks. His nose and mouth are too enormous, and he pastes his hair down to his head and wears his clothes frightfully. He really is anything but good-looking." She had had this very strict upbringing, this Kensington system that her mother, the Duchess of Kent, had put in place. A very, very overbearing upbringing. And Albert seemed to want to continue this system for his own children, that they were educated by frequent whippings, the girls and the boys. And as is so often the case, if you try and push your children too hard, if you're too strict with them, if you try and impose your own views on them too heavily, they resist it more and more and they move in the other direction. And Edward seemed to have spent his entire life trying to be the opposite of his mother, Queen Victoria. She became appalled by his appetites and his sexual activities. She thought he was immoral. Albert went further and thought he was depraved. And the more they treated him like this, the more he behaved like that. He was brought up to speak English, German, and French. He seemed to have enjoyed German the most, and that was the language he found easier and mostly spoke when he was small. And for the whole of his life, he actually spoke with a German accent. But his governess and his various tutors said he was slow to learn, that he didn't keep up with his younger brothers and sisters, and that he developed a stammer and a temper. There was a craze in the Victorian era for phrenology. This is a pseudoscience where people believed that you could read someone's character by studying the shape of their head and feeling all the lumps and bumps and indentations. And a famous phrenologist called George Coombe studied the prince's cranium, and he declared that the feeble quality of the brain will render the prince highly excitable. Intellectual organs are only moderately well developed. The result will be strong self-will, at times obstinacy. It's mumbo-jumbo, like card reading and palm reading. Basically, it's a magic trick mixed with a bit of psychology. It's about telling whoever has asked for the reading or the study to be done exactly what they want to hear. And while Bertie didn't grow up to be an intellectual, he did grow up to be a fairly genial type who could get on with all sorts of people. Politicians, writers, scientists, musicians, even ordinary people. He made an effort to be pleasant and get on with everyone, and he was considered to be very good company. So, as I say, Edward was not like his father, who was very famously brainy, but actually he was very similar to his mother, Victoria, who was no intellectual either. And perhaps, again, this is another reason why she disliked him in that she saw so much of herself in him, maybe not even being conscious of seeing that, and that she didn't see any of her beloved Albert in him. And often in families, we struggle with a family member who is most like us. When she was young, Victoria had been this fun-loving party girl, and she always thought herself a dunce compared to the brainy Prince Albert. Maybe she was disappointed to see that Edward had taken after her and not him. But her efforts to force Bertie to become intelligent unsurprisingly didn't work, and his strict education had the opposite effect on him than what was intended. He feared his father, which may have led to his stammer. He didn't write nearly as much as his mother had done, and combined with the fact that he had most of his letters destroyed at the end of his life, we don't have so much written evidence from him. He didn't like to write. But as I say, he found his pleasures elsewhere. He liked to play cards, particularly this fairly new game that was becoming a bit of a craze, bridge. He enjoyed the theatre, he enjoyed lively company, he liked to travel, and he enjoyed sports, particularly blood sports, but also horse racing and yachting. He was also a very keen golfer, and apparently he was also a very good goalkeeper in ice hockey, probably because he was so huge, nobody could get a puck past him. He was particularly fond of horse racing and loved attending meetings. For the great British public, this helped to make him one of them. Horses from his stable won 3 derbies and a Grand National. His best year was 1900, when he won the Grand National, the 2000 Guineas, the Newmarket Stakes, the Eclipse, the Derby and the St. Ledger, making the Prince the leading owner with nearly £30,000 in winnings and bets. So his was a more relaxed, popular, pleasure-loving and public reign than his mother's, and his genial, sociable, uncomplicated nature put him in good stead when he became a sort of roving ambassador for the royal family, for Queen Victoria, for his mother. Queen Victoria, because she didn't like him, because she wanted nothing to do with him, kept him at arm's length and kept him away from the everyday running of Parliament and royal business. She would send him abroad so that he wasn't hanging around trying to interfere at home. And that became his sort of raison d'etre, gave a bit of a meaning to his life. He travelled to America, to Canada, to Russia, to France, Germany, all over the place. And as he got older, he took to holidaying in the Mediterranean. He loved staying at Biarritz. He went there every year. He loved boating. And he was often sent out to smooth relationships with an awkward relative, because he was related to most of the crowned heads in Europe. So it gave him something to do. It gave him a meaning. One of the other things he wanted to do, he wanted to join the army. And he had hoped to join it like any other soldier and go to Sandhurst, pass his exams and become an officer. But they said, oh, no, Bertie, you don't need to do that. You're the Prince of Wales. We'll make you a lieutenant colonel. So it was just a meaningless position for him. And so his military ambitions were thwarted. Despite his lack of intellectual prowess, he managed to go to university. In fact, he went to 3 universities. He went to Oxford, Cambridge and Edinburgh. He started out at Oxford, where he was very disappointed that his father, Albert, wouldn't let him join a college like the other students, but had to stay with some aristocratic relatives nearby. So once again, his chance of sort of trying to muck in and be like everyone else was thwarted. After some time at Oxford, he went up to Edinburgh, and then he came back down to Cambridge. But despite attending 3 universities, he didn't seem to come out of it any brighter than he'd gone in. And indeed, his time at university seems to be remembered more for his sexual antics than his studying. While he was at Cambridge, his pals arranged that he would lose his virginity, and they sneaked an Irish actress called Nellie Clifton into his rooms. Soon after that, Edward did have a brief foray into trying to be a soldier. In the summer of 1861, he went to an army camp at the Curragh near Dublin. He liked the uniforms and the parades, but his commander-in-chief said he would never make a good professional soldier. But also, while he was there, his fellow soldiers smuggled Nellie Clifton into his tent on several occasions, word got out about this, and Nellie Clifton herself was not discreet. She liked to boast about it, and this became a bit of a scandal. Daddy, Albert, went stomping up to Cambridge to have a man-to-man with Edward, and they walked around the university grounds in a bit of a cold drizzle. Where Albert seemed to be mollified, Edward must have said the right thing to him, because Albert came back saying, I think he's going to be all right. I think I've straightened him out. Unfortunately, Albert died soon afterwards of typhoid fever, and Victoria, for the rest of her life, blamed Edward for this. She said it was the stress of Albert having to deal with Edward and to talk to him in the rain. But actually, it was a typhoid fever, nothing to do with Edward at all. But it suited Victoria to blame Edward. And she never let Albert go. She kept his rooms exactly as they were. She didn't let anyone speak of him as if he was dead. So Edward was not able to ever really fully replace him in his mother's heart and mind. He was never really able to step out from under his father's shadow and grow up to be a responsible adult. Now, before he had died, Albert had agreed with Victoria that Edward should marry Princess Alexandra of Denmark. This would be a good political alliance. The Scandinavian countries were always useful as a good counterbalance against this big power block in Europe of France and Germany. So alliances with these lesser kingdoms were very useful. Edward met Alexandra, and luckily they both liked each other. Alexandra was a notable beauty, and it seems an extremely nice and warm person. They were married at St. George's Chapel in Windsor in 1863, and they went on to have seemingly a contented, happy marriage, despite the fact that Edward was a terrible philanderer, and Alexandra knew about this, but she chose to turn a blind eye to it. She enjoyed Edward's company. She didn't like her mother-in-law. And on paper, all of Alexandra's children were apparently born prematurely. But it has been suggested that Alexandra and Edward lied about the dates to make sure that Victoria was never around for when any of the children were born. And Princess Alexandra had six children, despite the fact that she suffered from rheumatic fever, which attacked her regularly and actually caused her to have a limp. And later on, she became quite deaf. And as I say, Edward was pretty open about his sex life, even though none of these women were considered better looking than his actual wife. And Princess Alexandra basically just threw herself into bringing up her children, which, unlike Victoria, she really enjoyed. She loved being with them. She loved playing with them. She was considered dignified, charming, very affectionate, jolly. She liked dancing. She liked ice skating, riding horses. She was kind of like Princess Victoria was, and the young Queen Victoria, before things went wrong for her. And because after Albert's death, Victoria secluded herself away, Edward and Alexandra became the sort of public face of the royal family. And they were both very good at it. They were both very charming. They set up at Marlborough House in Pall Mall. Edward also bought a house in Norfolk, Sandringham, because there was very good shooting there. He loved shooting animals and birds, and pretty much for the rest of his life, he would spend most weekends at Sandringham. He even brought in a system known as Sandringham time, where all the clocks in Sandringham were set to a different time to the rest of the country to allow more hours of daylight in which to shoot things. Edward and Alexandra became the sort of centre of the royal court, the public-facing part of it. Victoria, hidden away, gloomy, not wanting to see anyone, spending a lot of time in Windsor and up in Balmoral. But Edward, at Marlborough House and at Sandringham House, loved parties. He loved entertaining. He loved schmoozing people. And this was the place to be. Once again, the monarchy was at the centre of society, where Victoria had withdrawn from everything. Edward was opening everything up. Now, as I say, the Queen didn't let Edward get involved in Parliament. She didn't let him see any of the cabinet papers that she had access to. He was given a précis of some things. It seems she was jealously guarding her own power. But the prince made friends with a guy called Lord Rosebery. And when he was foreign secretary, he began secretly sending stuff to Edward. And it didn't help Edward's relationship with his mother that he sided with the liberal Gladstone while she sided with the conservative Disraeli. It was a classic case of the child taking on the opposite politics of their parents. So Edward's life started to revolve around these various social seasons, which coincided with the sort of actual seasons. He mostly lived in London or at Sandringham. In August, we had Cowes Week, which is this great yachting event based on the Isle of Wight, where Victoria had a house. She attended Cowes Week, and it was the big social event of the year. Anybody that was anybody went to Cowes. And Prince Edward had his own boat, which he often stayed on when it was racing. And in the spring, he went to the Riviera, particularly, as I say, Biarritz. And as I mentioned before, the other big passion of his was horse racing. And he bred horses for racing as well. And actually, in later life, had huge success. And I'll come on to that later. As I say, Prince Edward had many mistresses, and he seemed to have had a penchant for getting off with other men's wives. I don't know why this was. Perhaps it was there was less chance of them getting too involved with him. And for most of the time, people sort of turned a blind eye to this. But there were a couple of occasions where it didn't go well for Edward. Divorce at the time was a very convoluted process that often involved quite public court cases. If a man wanted to divorce his wife, he would have to prove that she had been unfaithful to him, and he would have to name the person or persons she had been unfaithful with. And when Sir Charles Morton came to sue for divorce from his wife, Harriet Sarah, he threatened to name Prince Edward as one of his wife's lovers. The great and the good tried to shut this down and persuade him not to, but it did go ahead. Mordaunt said, OK, I won't cite him as a co-respondent. But nevertheless, Edward was subpoenaed to appear as a witness. It was obviously highly irregular for a royal to appear in court and was much talked about. Edward took the stand for 7 minutes, where he denied committing adultery and he was not cross-examined. But of course, this became a huge scandal. And because Victoria had instilled these very strict morals in the British people, they turned against Edward and booed him in public. And there was a big rise in republicanism. There was a real danger that this might lead to the downfall of the monarchy. We see this happening a lot today when you have some minor royal scandal and suddenly certain newspapers are saying, this behaviour is disgraceful. If they don't pull up their socks, this will lead to the end of the royal family. Something must be done about these people. This is usually when some stuffy old git is complaining about Prince Harry or Meghan Markle. But the monarchy was saved and Edward was saved by the fact that he nearly died. This seems to be the most effective way of making the monarchy popular is to have one of them close to death or actually die. He caught typhoid fever in 1871, which was the same disease, of course, that his father had died from. And he was very close to death. And suddenly there was a hushed silence across the land. You know, was he going to pull through? The poet Alfred Austin, who amazingly went on to become the poet laureate, wrote some famous lines about this incident. Flashed from his bed, the electric tidings came. He is not better, he is much the same. That's interesting, that the electric tidings, because we're looking at speedy communications through the telegraph. And even though the Queen was told that Edward was just about to die, he miraculously pulled through. Cheering in the streets, the Prime Minister, Gladstone, wasted no time in putting together a Thanksgiving service in St. Paul's Cathedral, which he persuaded the Queen to attend. And the royal party were cheered through the streets of London. The threat of republicanism went away. This happened for Edward again later in life when he was shot at in Belgium. Suddenly, he was instantly popular again. And as we saw in the last episode, seven people took pot shots at Queen Victoria. And each time, she became more popular. So, as I say, Edward travelled extensively as a royal envoy. He went to Egypt, where he helped try and settle some of the problems in the Middle East. And in 1874, when he was 34, he went to India, where he seemed to have had a splendid time hunting, although the others found it hard to keep up with him. And on his very first day, he shot six tigers. This is extraordinary, I mean, particularly when you think now. Partly as a result of big game hunting, tigers are in danger of becoming extinct in India. To find six and to shoot them in one day is pretty good going. It's appalling. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how the system worked. Maybe it was like in England where you have gamekeepers who breed pheasants and grouse or whatever and make sure you got hundreds of them ready to be shot at. Maybe they did the same in India for British royalty, is to capture tigers and keep them somewhere and release them just so he can shoot them. Edward enjoyed his time in India, but he was appalled at some of the racist attitudes he came across from the British administrators out there. And he said, "This is disgusting. It's nonsensical." He complained to his mother, "Because a man has a black face and a different religion from our own, there is no reason why he should be treated as a brute." So he was pretty forward-thinking on that matter. And actually, when he came back and he talked about this, some of these British bigwigs in India were removed from their posts. It was while Edward was in India that Queen Victoria was declared Empress of India. And he was really furious about this because nobody had told him, particularly his mother, and he would have liked to have been there. So he hurried back. On the way, he found out he'd been challenged to a duel by Lord Randolph Churchill, the father of Winston Churchill. There was a quite complicated family dispute going on, and Edward had been drawn into this. I won't go into the details here, but the duel never happened. And Edward and Randolph Churchill didn't get on with each other at all until Edward formed a close friendship with Randolph's wife, Jenny Churchill, who is often cited as one of Edward's lovers. The Churchills were a very interesting family, actually. And I will definitely do a separate episode on Winston Churchill, who was such a big figure in British history and politics. Now, Churchill was descended from John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough, who we looked at in the episodes on William and Mary and Queen Anne, who was gifted Blenheim Palace by a grateful nation after his triumphs in the wars in Europe. And Blenheim Palace is this huge, it's like a small town, really. It's ridiculously large. And there must have been literally hundreds of servants running the place when you think about the grounds and the house itself. So enormously expensive to upkeep. And what we're seeing through the Victorian period and through this part of Edward's life is things changing for the British landed aristocracy. They're finding it harder and harder to survive because you have this classic situation where they are resource rich but cash poor. They have these huge houses. They have large amounts of land, which they get a big income from, but that income goes to running the house. And the house might be full of immensely expensive furniture and furnishings and paintings and statues and tapestries or whatever, but it is just not done to sell anything because this is the family heirloom. And it's also not done to get a proper job. The aristocracy did not work. That would bring on ridicule and scorn. One thing you were allowed to do was to go into politics. That was considered not work. But these estates were becoming increasingly so expensive to run that many of the aristocracy were struggling to survive. So you have all of these people who have titles and honours and respect in society, but no money. And on the other side of the Atlantic, in America, you have these enormously wealthy families who have no titles. They want to be legitimized. America is this booming, vibrant economy, new men being made all over, newly rich from the railroads, from gold, later on from oil. And they build these huge houses and they are considered the preeminent families in society. But they come to Europe and they feel inferior to these lords and ladies, kings and queens and princesses. And so this system comes into effect whereby American millionaires, I mean, by today's standards, they're billionaires, marry their daughters off to members of the English aristocracy. Their daughters get titles. They become countesses, duchesses, princesses even. But they bring with them a hefty dowry and an annual allowance from their wealthy fathers in America. And this works very well for members of the British aristocracy. They're marrying American heiresses left, right and centre. And money is pouring in. Now, at Blenheim, we have the Dukes of Marlborough. Randolph Churchill, Winston Churchill's father, was a lord, Lord Randolph Churchill, but he was not the heir to the estate. So the way these things work, the eldest son inherits the estate. They inherit the house, the land, and everything on it. Lord Randolph, as the second son, inherits very little. He is impoverished, so he does what a couple of his cousins have done. He marries an American heiress, Jenny Jerome. Unfortunately, Jenny's father was a bit of a charlatan. He was not one of these fabulously wealthy Americans. Occasionally he came into money, but he tended to spend it and pay off his debts or rack up some new debts gambling. So she never brought the promised riches. And she and Winston argued for the rest of their lives over spending too much money. Winston always accused his mother of buying too many dresses, and Jenny always accused Churchill of buying too much champagne and cigars and having too much fun. And we often forget that Winston Churchill was half American. So there was this big transatlantic trade, if you like, between heiresses and the aristocracy. But also a lot of these American families were now coming over and starting to have a bit of a foothold in England. And Edward himself actually really liked a lot of these guys. He made friends with a lot of these wealthy Americans and a lot of wealthy British people too. And as we know, several of these wealthy Americans were Jewish. Many penniless Jews had fled to America in this period to escape pogroms, mainly in Russia and Eastern Europe. And when they got to America, they worked very hard and a few of them became very wealthy. And Edward enjoyed their company as much as he enjoyed the company of all these other wealthy men. And his group of friends around him became known as the Marlborough Set. So Edward was quite a free thinker. He got involved in a royal commission on the housing of working class people. And he secretly visited the East End slums in disguise. And he did want to do something about this. So he was trying to do good alongside sleeping with people's wives and actresses such as Lily Langtry and Sarah Bernhardt. And amongst the aristocracy, there was Lady Brooke, known as Daisy. She became known actually as Babbling Brook because she kept spilling the beans on what Edward was up to. And particularly there was this strange incident which became another scandal in Edward's life. He was staying in the north with a wealthy northern landowner, a place called Tranby Croft near Hull. And he loved card games and he suggested they had a game of baccarat, also known as Chemin de Fer, various other names. It appears in very many James Bond films. If you've never played it, it's very difficult to work out what the hell is going on. It was actually banned in England at the time. You were allowed to play it, but you weren't allowed to play it for money. And it was a strange judgment. It was illegal because there was no skill involved in the game at all. It was purely a game of chance. And apparently gambling on a game of chance was illegal. But they had some games at Tranby Croft and some of the people there became convinced that one of the players, Sir William Gordon Cumming, who was a big military figure, was cheating. And eventually an accusation was made. And despite him saying he wasn't cheating, he signed this document saying, "I will never play cards again and I will never mention this incident." But there were too many people involved and the secret soon got out. And it led to a big court case. Sir William tried to defend himself. He eventually lost. Edward was involved in all of this, and it was another scandal. Another example of Edward's immoral lifestyle. But he weathered the scandal. And meanwhile, his children were growing up. His eldest son was also called Edward, and he was known as Prince Eddie. And he was the next in line to the throne. He was the Duke of Clarence. Alexandra and Edward were a bit worried about him. He was a bit of a flaky figure, slightly untrustworthy. But Edward, the Prince of Wales, was still absolutely heartbroken when young Eddie died in 1892 of a fever. Edward, unlike Victoria and all the Georgies, had a very good relationship with his children. He loved them and they loved him, and he was a very warm father figure. But there was some relief in the royal court that Edward's second son, George, was now in line to the throne because he was considered a much safer bet. He was a serious, studious and reliable boy. And he, luckily, had a very good relationship with his father, Edward. And as Edward grew older, he took up with two new women who he was to keep close for the rest of his life. A matron at a nursing home for army officers called Sister Agnes Kaiser, and another woman known as Alice Frederica Keppel. Queen Victoria eventually died in January of 1901. She had just scraped into the 20th century. So when Edward came to the throne, he was almost 60, overweight and ageing, but still filled with energy. It seemed that he needed to be active or he got bored very quickly. And so despite his age, this was an exciting time for Britain. The historian Colin Matthew described the prince's accession to the throne as a striking moment in the history of the British monarchy. Like Pip at the end of the film of Great Expectations, Edward VII tore down the drapes of the Victorian court and let the light flood in. Yes, he transformed the royal court, which for the last 40 years had been gloomy and stagnant. Edward entertained or dined out almost every evening. He liked to host parties. He liked to go to parties. And helped by a handy boost to the royal income that made him the highest paid British monarch ever, he set about remodelling, rebuilding and updating. His June coronation had to be delayed, however, as he was struck down by appendicitis and peritonitis. The news was kept from the public, but the royal court has its history of not allowing royal illnesses to get out into the public domain. And they gave an explanation of lumbago for the postponed coronation. Luckily, Bertie survived his operation and was just well enough to be crowned in August in a somewhat truncated ceremony. And unfortunately, by then, all the various foreign royal dignities had gone home. Now, once he was king, Bertie carried on this process of schmoozing European monarchs. He was now getting older than most of them, and he had a sort of avuncular relationship with them. He got on with all of them except his nephew, Kaiser Wilhelm II, who he thought was stuck up and pompous, and said of him, "William the Great needs to learn that he is living at the end of the 19th century and not in the Middle Ages." Edward was much more realistic and modern in his attitude towards the monarchy. He understood that it was a constitutional position and that the business of running things was best left to other people. But that was not Kaiser Wilhelm's attitude. And the two of them kept falling out with each other. Edward kept offending Wilhelm, and Wilhelm really didn't like Edward. And Edward was trying to make friends with all the other monarchs around Europe because he was scared of Wilhelm. He was scared that Germany was militarizing itself, that it was building up its wealth and its power, and that it was going to become a very unstabilizing presence in Europe. Wilhelm started building battleships, steam-driven wooden ships clad in iron, known as ironclads. The British government responded by building their first dreadnought. This was the very first all-iron ship. There was no wood involved. And Wilhelm responded by building some of his own dreadnoughts. And this led to something of an arms race. The Conservatives in the British Parliament, and particularly in the House of Lords, were arguing that we should be building more dreadnoughts. But the Liberals had managed to take control of the Commons. Politics was becoming quite polarised. The Liberals were pushing for reform. They were pushing for some kind of support for the poor. This was the glimmerings of a welfare state. They wanted to reduce military spending and increase social spending. Inevitably, the Conservatives took the opposite view. But under Herbert Asquith, the Liberals gained power. And this was something of a high point for the Liberal Party. They never really held power like that again. But change was in the air. And this was a radical movement to help the people of Britain and not just to exploit them. The Conservatives cared little for the working classes. They wanted battleships and came up with a slogan, "We want eight and we won't wait." As far as they were concerned, the rising power of Germany had to be threatened. So the Liberals pulled back on some of their demands and allowed for some new dreadnoughts to be built, as long as they could also establish an old age pension for the first time. The whole package to be funded by a big hike in taxation for the very wealthy. However, the House of Lords, which was weighted towards the Conservatives, blocked these reforms and repeatedly refused to pass the bill. The Duke of Beaufort threatened to set his dogs on the Chancellor David George and his radical colleague and ally Winston Churchill, who was a Liberal politician at the time. David Lloyd George later said, "A fully equipped Duke costs as much to keep up as two dreadnoughts, and Dukes are just as great a terror, and they last longer." This all led to a period known as the constitutional crisis. Asquith and Lloyd George urged Edward to create more Liberal peers in order to overwhelm the Conservatives in the Lords. Edward didn't like the idea, thought it wouldn't look good, and instead told the Liberals to call a general election and see who the people supported. In fact, there was a series of inconclusive general elections, and in the end, the Liberals had to form a coalition with Irish nationalists, who were pushing for Irish independence, and the nascent Labour Party under Keir Hardie. The constitutional crisis and these rolling arguments were still going on at the time of Edward's death. But overall, the last thing Edward wanted was another war. We'd just come through the Second Boer War, where a bunch of Dutch farmers had, for a long time, been able to have the upper hand against the British army. It was only by bringing in new and underhand tactics, like building concentration camps, that the British were able to finally defeat the Boers. But it was seen that the British army was useless, because British working class men were undernourished, diseased, shriveled. They were growing smaller and smaller with each generation. And despite the sort of posters showing these big, proud, strapping British soldiers, that was not the case at all. And it was considered that even if it was just to make sure we had healthier soldiers, something needed to be done to help the working classes, to give them better housing, better health, better nutrition. So this is all part of this big drive in the Edwardian era for better living conditions for the ordinary people of Britain. Asquith's government was even known as the People's Parliament. Edward had a little bit more success on the world stage, and one thing that he managed to achieve as part of his international diplomacy was the establishment of a better relationship with France. He was central to putting into place what became known as the Entente Cordiale, a friendly alliance between England and France. Finally, after hundreds of years of mutual aggression between us and them, it was over. Now, Edward basically went on a goodwill mission to Paris, shaking hands, slapping backs, being chummy and mollifying. Initially, the French were a bit resistant to him. They didn't think too highly of this English royal coming over, trying to make friends with the post-revolutionary French. But apparently, what swung things in Edward's favour was a visit to the theatre. During the interval, the king was socialising in the foyer when he spotted a French actress he knew, Jeanne Granier, and he said to her in fluent French, well, I'll do it in fluent English, Mademoiselle, I remember applauding you in London, where you represented all the grace and spirit of France. The king's gesture in going up and saying hello to her, and his words about her and about France, went round Paris, and the visit became a triumph. Unfortunately, Edward's relationship with his nephew, Kaiser Wilhelm, never improved, and a mutual antagonism between England and Germany grew ever worse through Edward's reign. And then his lifestyle eventually caught up with him, and in 1910 he suffered a series of heart attacks. The last thing he said before he died was in response to the news that one of his horses, Witch of Ayr, had won at Kempton Park that afternoon. "Yes," he said, "I have heard of it. I am very glad." So Edward had ushered in a welcome escape from Victorianism. The Edwardian period was one of change and energy. Yes, perhaps it was all a bit brash and vulgar, but that's what the British people wanted. That's what the British people like. Edward was in step with Britishness. Now make sure you stick with me and come back after the break when I'll be discussing Edward with his biographer, Jane Ridley.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back. My guest on this episode is Jane Ridley, a historian, biographer, author and broadcaster and professor of modern history at the University of Buckingham. Jane has written several books about the Victorian and Edwardian era, including the excellent little book about Queen Victoria in the Penguin Monarchs series and Bertie, A Life of Edward VII. And her most recent book is George V, Never a Dull Moment. So welcome, Jane. It's fantastic to have you on.
Well, Charlie, it's very good to be here.
So tell me, what led you to write your biography of Edward? And I mean, did you change your opinions about him in the process?
Yeah. Well, I decided to write about him for the simple reason that he didn't seem to have any very recent biographies. I mean, the last one had been written sort of, you know, 50 years ago or so. Mm. The Edwardian period is the period I love. So it seemed, you know, a book that I really couldn't turn down. And I did find that my ideas changed as I wrote the book. His reputation is not a particularly good one, and that this was unfair in some cases, I felt.
A lot of that seems to have actually stemmed from Queen Victoria, who really didn't seem to like him and accused him of being stupid and immoral and whatever.
I mean, almost from day one, poor Bertie can do nothing good. He's the second child. The first child, Vicky, was a sort of gifted child, and she could do nothing. You know, she was absolutely amazing, was doing Greek when she was two, you know. And by comparison, Bertie was really a rather plodding little boy with none of her charm and not so brainy as her. His mother, you never get the feeling that she really loved him. I remember when I was doing the research, reading the letters that Victoria wrote to Bertie. I mean, they were sort of pretty aggressive and brutal, saying how ugly he was and how, you know, how terrible his hair was. And then sort of silly things like he mustn't sit on the sofa except if he's out hunting or something, you know. I mean, she didn't have any sort of feeling for him at all. And I think this is quite interesting because it's very much something that seems to happen with the Hanoverian monarchs, that they quarrel with their heirs. And Victoria, in some ways, is just sort of following this tradition. Somebody said that the Habsburgs are like ducks. They stand on their offspring.
Okay, it's hard to grasp, I think, because with our modern sensibilities, that you know, there's so much written about parenting and good parenting and bad parenting. And when Victoria had such a miserable time herself with the whole Kensington system, that she would then inflict a similarly bullying system on her own children.
I agree. It is hard to grasp. She had a view that royal children mustn't be spoilt. Mm. They must learn that they're not special. They're not sort of, and that I think is admirable, to try and sort of, you know, not let them be spoilt little princes. But I think she took it far too far. And I think one has to bring Albert into this too, because Albert was in charge of the children's education, and particularly of Bertie's education, particularly important because Bertie was the heir. And Albert played a leading part in setting up for Bertie an incredibly demanding programme of lessons. Poor little boy, aged sort of 6 or 7, was working all day almost. And when he was doing lessons, he was on his own. I mean, well, he had a tutor, but no other children. Mm. You know, he was somebody who really loved having lots of people around him. He was an extrovert very much. And so part of the torture was that he had no little friends.
Mm. You know, Victoria dismissed him as stupid. And you wouldn't describe him as an intellectual, but I mean, he doesn't seem to have been, his behaviour when he got older, necessarily acting like a completely stupid person, as it were.
No, he wasn't stupid. Saying he was stupid was really sort of another way of saying he wasn't like Albert. Mm. And Albert had an incredibly, I'm sure, high intelligence and liked nothing better as a little boy to settle down to some really difficult book. Bertie wasn't like that. He was much more like Victoria. He had an amazing memory for people and names and things like that, which is actually a good asset if you're going to be king, because you really do recognise these people. You're not just pretending. You know, he was good enough to certainly to make a good king. He wasn't stupid at all. He just wasn't an intellectual, an academic.
And, you know, his attributes of geniality and whatever seem to have done well for him in his roving ambassador role, as it were.
Yeah, you know, he was charming. He had very good manners. He spoke, this is another thing that makes us think he's not that stupid. He spoke several languages, particularly French and German. The little royal children were brought up in the nursery, actually, with German as being their first language and English only coming after that. And Bertie was good at these languages. He was able to communicate with French diplomats, for example, in a way that very few English politicians could do, because he really spoke very good French. And he practiced his languages on his valet before he went to bed each night. So he would talk to him in French or German.
Well, he must have had a very educated valet.
Well, I think he was French or German.
Edward does seem to have slightly broken the mould of parental relationships, in that he seems to have been very warm and loving with his own children.
He never said this, but I think he really thought that he wasn't going to inflict the same regime on his children as he'd endured as a child. And above all, that they must be happy. So whereas Bertie, as a child and a teenager, had been on his own with tutors all the time and no hardly any company, his children enjoyed an almost sort of idyllic childhood, spending long periods of time at Sandringham, at home in the country, having a sort of country child. None of his children complained that they had an awful childhood.
Well, you've written about George. Is there any way that you can look at his upbringing and say, actually, that was probably a better upbringing for what George had to go through?
Yes, I think George's upbringing definitely was better. But George's schooling was still pretty difficult. I mean, he was sent off to Dartmouth with his brother at the age of 11 or something and not seen for many, many months. A lot of separation from his parents, but all well-meaning. I mean, you know, was going to let him grow up into a very good naval officer, they hoped.
Edward obviously had a pretty short reign and came to it very late in life. In retrospect, do we say that he was a good monarch, that he navigated the waters well?
The conventional view of Edward as a king is that he was really not very good, that he was lazy. He didn't read the documents in his red boxes. He was only interested in the pleasures of life, and he may have been good at giving dinner parties, but that's not really enough. He wasn't really doing the work that he was supposed to do. And this view is outrageous. It's not right. I mean, right. It's true that before he became king, Bertie behaved in that way and you know, had a very sort of active social life and huge meals and all of that. And of course, it continues to an extent. But what changes when he becomes king is his whole sort of attitude towards the life of a royal person. He really always does stay up late with his red boxes. He has audiences with a huge amount of people. He's very, very busy as king. And I think it's never really possible to tell whether somebody who's been an heir to the throne is actually going to turn out to be a good monarch. Mm. This is something that does happen with Bertie. He changes. He becomes, even though he succeeds at, you know, quite late in life, he becomes a much more committed and effective person.
And also, he does seem to have grasped how the idea of a constitutional monarchy works, the sort of limits of his power. And that does seem to be that he was always complaining about his nephew Wilhelm, that Wilhelm didn't really seem to grasp that and wanted to be an old school emperor, as it were.
Yes, that's true. First part of that question about Bertie being a effective constitutional monarch, I completely agree with. And I think that it's been overlooked. I mean, the point was that Victoria never really accepted that as queen, there were certain limits to her power and she shouldn't get mixed up with party politics. She's allowed to have her own opinions in private, but not in public. Mm. Bertie does understand this, and Bertie does actually put this into action. I mean, he has a real claim to be described as the first proper constitutional monarch in Britain. He doesn't get stuck into party politics, and he becomes seen as a figure who's able to resolve difficulties that nobody else can resolve. And this is very clear when you look at Bertie's role in the sort of constitutional crisis of 1909/10. Mm-hmm. He's seen then as being the only person really who would be able to broker some kind of a compromise to stop the sort of logjam that had happened to the political parties. So that is very important. And that's perhaps his chief achievement as monarch, or one of his most important ones. And of course, there is a difference with the Kaiser. But of course, the Kaiser comes from a different constitutional background. I mean, Germany is a sort of autocracy. And so the Kaiser, in theory, is ruling. It's a different system from the British system. But I think it's true to say that the Kaiser's power in politics begins to decline before 1914. He's no longer really in control of it. The politicians have taken over.
Talking about 1914, there seems to have been this sort of gradual slide towards conflict with Germany, starting in Victoria's reign, really, and going through Edward's. I mean, how inevitable was the First World War?
Well, I mean, I think you could argue that for a very long time, but rephrasing the question very slightly, how inevitable was it that Britain should become involved in the First World War?
Right.
Edward was very concerned about the risks and dangers of war in the last few years of his reign. He thought the Kaiser was a really dangerous figure because he was so uncontrolled and didn't really understand what was going on. But Edward, I think, was depressed about this and felt that, you know, that there was really no alternative to war if the Kaiser was to remain in the position that he was in. It's the long shadow that clouds the last years of his reign.
And, you know, as with any build-up to war, you have the two, you tend to fall into two groups of the pro and the anti-war factions, which just seemed to be all completely tied up in the whole constitutional crisis that was going on. I mean, if Edward hadn't died in the middle of all that, do you think the outcome might have been different?
I'm afraid I don't really. Edward was succeeded by his son George when he died in 1910. George got on much better with the Kaiser than Edward did, because George didn't threaten the Kaiser, whereas Edward was always sort of making the Kaiser feel inadequate. Edward was the big man of Europe, and the Kaiser was made to feel that he was a silly little nephew. And yet, in spite of the fact that George has these good relations with the Kaiser, George certainly had no illusions that he would be able to put the brakes on the Kaiser and stop him behaving in the way that he was behaving, going straight to war. I think the same would have been true with Edward. He wouldn't have been able to stop the Kaiser.
So did the British political establishment solidify into a sort of pro-war majority?
I think that's a good question. Even the Liberal government is in favour of some kind of a war against Germany, if only as a sort of distraction to what's going on in Ireland, where there's a danger of civil war. We need to put this into context, and that is that everybody thought that the war would be over by Christmas, having broken out in September. That made it a very different prospect than what we see as the prospect in retrospect.
Well, we've got all that to come in the episode on George V. So let's put politics and the war to one side for the moment and look at Bertie as a person. I think the one thing that most people know about Edward is, oh, he was the playboy prince. He had loads of mistresses. He smoked cigars and liked to be with pretty women. And Alexandra seems to have gone along with this. How did their relationship work?
At one level, Bertie is a marvellous husband to Alexandra. He allows her to stay in the country, which is where she wants to be. and also has a very strong sense of what the rights and wrongs of behaviour by a monarch are. And I think Alexandra therefore understood that with this masculinity, which Bertie subscribed to, it was all right to have mistresses so long as you were loyal to your wife.
Right.
And in her case, I think it was something much harder, which was that she was incredibly loyal to him. I mean, she could have gone public over his misbehaviours and she could have really had a damaging effect on him, but she didn't. She was profoundly loyal. And I suppose he was grateful to her for that.
And so, I mean, was she sort of in the position of all those medieval queens who, for them, the most important thing was the line of succession, that their son would be on the throne, so don't upset the system?
That's a very good point. She was. And she understood that world. I mean, it was the world in which she operated. But of course, that meant the fact that her eldest son, Eddie, Duke of Clarence, died suddenly at the age of 28 and the succession was sort of yanked away to a different prince. This for Alexandra was something that she could never get over, I think. Even though a lot of people sighed a huge sigh of relief that Eddie had died because he was... very weak-natured and had none of the intelligence of his father, but all the vices.
So there was a feeling that we'd dodged a bullet, though.
Yes, exactly.
Do we know what she thought, and did she ever try to make any pronouncements or get involved in the sort of the politics of the time or what was going on? I mean, do we know what she felt about the suffragette movement, for instance?
Suffragette movement, I don't think, was something that she sympathised particularly. She had a very different idea of what women ought to do. What she was good at was the sort of semiotics of dress.
Mm.
And she was much more interested in foreign politics than she was really in British politics.
Right.
She had, particularly if she was concerned about her brother, Willie, who was King George I, the King of Greece, which was a notoriously difficult place to rule. And of course, he was assassinated in the last year of his reign.
And is he the ancestor of Prince Philip?
Yes, but various sort of jinx in the line, I think.
Oh, right. It was inevitable, I suppose, that Bertie and Alexandra were going to get so involved with foreign affairs and what these European royal families were up to, because they were closely related to nearly all of them.
Yes, indeed. There was this sort of monarch's trade union going on in Europe in the run-up to the First World War. In Russia and Germany, you have two autocratic emperors who are also very young, inexperienced men, and not either of them, the Kaiser or the Tsar Nicholas II, particularly able. Nicky works very hard and he's very sort of conscientious, but he's not impressive. And certainly Bertie had no time for him. The fact that you've got these two young men in these vast empires means that Bertie, the uncle, he has a definite role to play in sort of making them behave the way he thinks they ought to make, sort of being a sort of dominant figure within this monarchical Europe. And I think he does that well.
It's extraordinary that so much effort has gone to making these marriages and these alliances and being connected all around Europe, and yet the whole thing still fell apart.
Well, yes, but it did fall apart, but it didn't fall apart in this country. I mean, most of the emperors fell off their thrones and also many kings in Europe. But obviously the monarchy did not collapse here. I think that's partly because wars are good things for kings when they turn out well. If you win the war, it's very good for your prestige. And that was certainly the case here.
I always find it extraordinary that even though these monarchs were pretty much all in the same family, they still fell out and went to war. But I mean, I guess maybe that's how dysfunctional families work. You choose which members you support in a family argument.
Basically, what happened during the reign of Edward VII was that Britain had to make a choice between aligning itself with Russia and with France or with Germany. And it made the choice to go with Russia and with France. And so we have the Kaiser and Austria rather isolated. And Bertie tries to see it as his role to sort of triangulate this by being friendly with the Kaiser and getting the Kaiser on board, even though they're not going to be in any kind of diplomatic relationship. And so there are various meetings that take place between the king and the emperor, the Kaiser and Bertie. And these meetings usually are rather unsuccessful because both men are sort of allergic to each other. And whenever either of them says or does anything, the other one immediately contradicts him. And, you know, it's not really going very far. But he is attempting, Bertie, to do what I think was the role of a constitutional monarch as it evolved, which was to sort of use soft power to push the person you're talking to in the direction that you want them to go.
Let's get back to Edward's private life, his personal life. he's still seen as the sort of the jolly playboy prince, but some sort of modern attitudes towards him might write him off as a sort of just another toxic male abusing his power. What was his relationship with his mistresses, and how much was it sexual and how much was it companionship?
I think the relationship with the mistresses changes as he gets older. As a young man, I found some aspects of his behaviour really quite sort of putting off. As you say, toxic male, exploiting his power over women who were in a very weak position and not really sort of helping them when they got into trouble. His attitude at that stage is a kind of sort of a rather sort of awful masculinity, that this is, you know, the way that properly macho princes should behave. But as time goes on, and he gets into his 40s, 50s, 60s, the relationship with the mistresses is much more grown up, if you like. And instead of having a lot of relationships, which really mean very little to him, there are a series of relationships with just one woman at a time, rather than lots of mistresses going on. And these are really, in many ways, similar to second or third marriages. Mm. I mean, they last quite a long time. Particularly Mrs. Keppel, the last of these mistresses, is almost expected to be there all the time with the king, except when he's with his wife. And I think that with these later relationships, it's very helpful to Bertie, because they're often, you know, they're intelligent, these women. They're intelligent and strong-minded. People like Jenny Churchill or Lady Warwick, Daisy Warwick. I mean, they keep him entertained. I think the big question about these ladies is that the relationship with the women is how the mistresses is how he's able to go on doing this. It's all kept terribly private is the reason. And I think this is also important. Nobody outside the small circle of the king's friends would have known what was going on.
Right.
The newspapers were gagged. I mean, the newspapers didn't report royal scandal unless it was a divorce. It got into the papers if it was a divorce, because that was legally allowed. But otherwise, they kept clear of that.
So what was your conclusion having written the book? Do we put him on the list of good kings, good people, or like most of us, is he somewhere in the middle?
He became a good person.
Right.
But I think he started with these poor women whose lives he ruined. Mm. What's interesting in the biography is that it starts with him behaving in this way, which is really completely unacceptable, and becoming increasingly sort of human in his attitudes.
Well, he grew up, I suppose.
Yeah, he grew up, and I think he took a long time to grow up.
And what about his politics? The Edwardian period does seem to have been a time of modernisation, a time where people were really trying to do something about poverty. And Edward served on a royal commission, seeing what could be done. I mean, was he just going along with these things, or did he genuinely want to help the working classes?
Well, I think he was going along with things, but he agreed with doing these things. He certainly played a big part in trying to raise money for the building of new hospitals. An awful lot of hospitals were built at this time. He was one of the few monarchs in Europe who had any contact with the sort of Jewish community. And Edward VII persuades the Jewish community to contribute to his hospitals to help these big projects. And in exchange, invites them to court, which didn't happen in any other European country. And I think this is actually quite enlightened. I mean, those hospitals are, many of them still, today, if you go into the front door, you see something about Alexandra or Bertie or Eddie. Yeah, I think that was the main thing he did in that direction.
Thank you so much, Jane. That was really interesting. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on Edward.
Thank you for asking me.
So that was Jane Ridley, author of the Penguin Monarchs book about Queen Victoria, and also Bertie, A Life of Edward VII. Who was certainly a monarch I'd like to read more about, actually. So make sure you join me next time when we look at the reign of George V, who was on the throne during the horrors of the First World War, a navy man who kept a steady hand on the tiller. Now, George is often painted as being a very dull man, but that view of him is perhaps being reconsidered, as we can see from Jane's book on King George, subtitled Never a Dull Moment. Now, I was going to put a plug in here for the official Willy Willy Harry Stee account on X, but we have some technical problems at the moment, as we seem to have fallen foul of the prudish Victorian algorithms at X, who don't like us using the words Willy Willy. But I will update you on that saga. Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willie Willie Harry Stee was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willie Willie Harry Stee, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.